Applebaum was born in Northern California to two poor, freewheeling secular Jews who never married. To call the environment of his early childhood a dysfunctional family wouldn't capture just how rarely it functioned at all. Applebaum describes his mother as a paranoid schizophrenic who split with his father before Applebaum was born. He would later hear stories that she believed his father had molested him while he was still in her womb. Applebaum's father was a heroin addict, and in the eyes of the court, was hardly more fit than his mother to care for their newborn son. The couple's custody fight would last a full decade of his life. During that prolonged legal battle, Applebaum lived with his mother's sister, but he says she wasn't ready for parenthood. At the age of 8, she sent him to live at the Sonoma County Children's Home. One of his only happy memories of the next lonely years, he says, was a night when an older child at the home taught him to hack the building's combination keypads by blowing chalk dust onto them, revealing the entry pattern in finger oils. Applebaum remembers slipping out into the night and wandering an empty baseball diamond, for a moment free and in control of his life. Applebaum would spend another 2 years in the home and in foster care before his father won custody of him. Despite seeing him rarely for the first 10 years of his life, Applebaum still paints his father in heroic terms. An actor, director, and member of a band called the Tattooed Vegetables, Ricky Applebaum ran in the same circles as Frank Zappa and the Lithuanian-American sculptor and dancer Vito Paulikas, and was known to have sported half a beard on one side of his face and half a mustache on the other. According to his son, he also became a serial burglar for several years in the 1970s, mostly robbing pharmacies to feed his addiction. The stories Applebaum shares of his father's exploits are legendary, if unconfirmable. How he learned to lift fingerprints from random surfaces, set them in latex, and plant them at the scenes of crimes. How he stole police cars, went joyriding, and crashed them. How, the night he was finally caught by the cops, he'd had a nervous breakdown and laid down behind the counter of a store he had broken into. In fact, no legal records show any convictions. Soon after moving in with his father, the young Applebaum says his father showed him how to crack a safe he kept in his office, listening to its inner workings with a stethoscope. Like his father, the younger Applebaum slipped naturally into life on the fringes of society, cross-dressing, dyeing his hair, and begging for change on the street. As much as he idolized his father, living in his drug-fueled, anarchic world was often nightmarish. The family spent much of its time in homeless shelters or moving from house to house. When they did settle down temporarily, Applebaum's father would sublet most of the rooms of their home to fellow junkies to pay for his own habit, leaving Applebaum with half of the kitchen as a bedroom and only a hanging sheet for privacy. Applebaum remembers the cast of housemates who inhabited that broken home. One lunatic, who believed he was Anthony Burgess and spent his time rewriting The Doctor Is Sick in blue ballpoint pen. A small balding man who spat on the floor. Two Rastafarian junkies who once used the light bulbs in Applebaum's bedroom to smoke mothballs. He woke up in the middle of the night to the sounds of their laughter, choking in the dark on the acrid fumes. One morning, he walked into the bathroom before school to find a woman convulsing in the tub with a syringe in her arm. Another day, Applebaum came home from school and found his own father overdosing on the couch. He had written a note. "Dear Jake, life is hard. Goodbye. I love you." Applebaum woke his father up, walked him around the house, and he survived. Despite those experiences, Applebaum doesn't blame his father for his tarnished childhood. Ricky Applebaum's inability to kick drugs, he believes, stems in part from a childhood accident. The elder Applebaum was hit by a drunk driver at the age of 9, and for the rest of his life, suffered from incurable pain. Applebaum himself was hit by a car while crossing the street at the age of 14. He was wearing a black dress, black tights, and a purple wig, and still suffers from chronic back injuries. "We weren't so different," he says. "I chose computers instead of heroin." Applebaum's first PC, in fact, was a gift from his father, a Macintosh 7290 that was almost certainly stolen. Junkies don't acquire things like that by buying them, he explains. A friend at school and a neighbor's father taught him about networking protocols, the inner workings of operating systems, simple programming. He read the Cypherpunk mailing list archives and rediscovered its lessons about the power of cryptography to counter authority and violence, how it shifts the balance of power from those with a monopoly on violence to those who comprehend mathematics and security design. And the digital world at large offered him an abstract realm free of the corruption of his psychotic and drug-addled home, a place unhooked from reality where he could reinvent himself at will. Applebaum had a knack for manipulating that world and its tools, but his formal education was cut short. At the age of 20, he dropped out of Santa Rosa Junior College to take care of his father, who by then was suffering from cirrhosis of the liver, hepatitis C, and diabetes. To pay his bills and those of his ailing father, he took a job working in a nonprofit that refurbished old computers for charity. On the side, he began volunteering for activist collectives and NGOs, groups with names like Resist.ca and the Ruckus Society. In 2002, those gigs led Applebaum to his first real job, an information technology administrator position at Greenpeace. It was a tougher and more practical education than anything he would have found at Santa Rosa Junior College. Applebaum learned from a combative, grizzled Linux guru at the NGO who went by the hacker handle Shored. His mentor and the rest of Greenpeace took information security seriously. The group's radical environmentalists often referenced the Rainbow Warrior, a ship Greenpeace used in its anti-whaling activities that was sabotaged and sunk by French intelligence agents in 1985, drowning one of the group's photographers. Greenpeace's security issues are real, says Applebaum. When things go badly, people die. Applebaum's induction into radical activism was also the beginning of his borderless lifestyle, flying around the world to participate in the group's direct actions. He helped perform reconnaissance for a San Francisco stunt in which the group dropped a massive banner over the Wells Fargo building to protest its funding of Appalachian mountaintop removal coal mining. At one point, he flew to Amsterdam to meet the Dutch cypherpunk Rob Gongrap and his business associates, who handed over Pelican cases of crypto phones. Greenpeace was among the first independent organizations to test those encryption-enabled mobile devices, now widespread among intelligence agencies and those that fear them. When he wasn't working for Greenpeace, Applebaum volunteered and contracted his computer skills to groups like the Rainforest Action Network, the Tactical Tech Collective, and the Open Society Institute. He met Roger Dingledine and Nick Mathewson at the DEF CON Hacker Conference at the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas, and soon began volunteering for Tor, too, running Tor nodes on whatever PCs he had available. Dingledine, in return, became Applebaum's educator in all things anonymous. Roger is the Gutenberg of anonymity. He taught me how to think, says Applebaum. They were welcoming. They had a community. I joined it. Out of his shattered childhood, Applebaum had assembled a life on the front lines of digital activism. And then it all fell apart again. Ricky Applebaum died 4 days before Christmas in a San Francisco hospital. The younger Applebaum blames the junkies who had shared his father's home. He says they had withheld his drugs, repeatedly injecting his legs instead with warm water. When Ricky Applebaum died of cirrhosis and infected abscesses in his legs, they left the apartment with practically everything he owned. The police, his son says, weren't interested in investigating. He claims they told him that no one cares about junkies, and instead threatened to arrest him for possessing his father's drug paraphernalia. My hatred of authority was pretty much solidified, he says. After his father's death, activism no longer felt like enough. Applebaum wanted to escape American society, to stop contributing to a world of bullshit evil, as he would later describe it. He decided to leave the United States and visit an old friend from Greenpeace who who had started a wireless infrastructure business in a place as far as possible from San Francisco and the ghost of his father, Iraq. No military escort or even a visa. He would smuggle himself over the northern border with Turkey. "I guess I was tired of my first world problems," Applebaum says. "I decided that I would either come back whole or come back full of holes." In the months before Julian Assange dropped out of college in 2005 to pursue his anti-authoritarian dreams, he was plagued by ideas that seemed to have lodged in his mind so deeply that when they emerged in discussions with fellow students, they burst forth almost as fully formed lectures. One of the topics over which Assange obsessed was the Bourbaki, a circle of 1930s French mathematicians who all wrote under the name Nicolas Bourbaki. The Bourbaki's goal was to create a new groundwork for mathematics out of solid and apparent first principles. Seeking to delete ego from their rigorous systematic work, they assumed the Bourbaki name to expel all public identity beyond that of the group itself. Assange dreamed of a group that would apply the same ideas to journalism, building stories out of public documents available to all, and posting them under a single pseudonymous byline. Another of Assange's idée fixe, one fellow student remembers, was onion routing. And over beers one evening in an Irish pub called Pug Mahoney's at the edge of Melbourne University, he laid out Paul Siverson's elegant idea to that friend in pedagogical detail. A wrapped ball of information shedding skins as it bounced between relays from secret origin to secret destination. The perfect conduit for Oscar Wilde's masked truth-teller. In 2005, Assange quit school and moved into a nearby house that became a proto-headquarters for what would become WikiLeaks. He covered the walls with blueprints for the site's architecture, code, and mathematical formulas. He worked for long hours, installed a red light bulb in his bedroom in an effort to regulate his sleep, and ate little. The house filled with fellow hackers and like-minded activists who would crash in the house rent-free in exchange for working on Assange's project. WikiLeaks, in its original conception, would use a wide variety of tricks to keep the world, and even itself, totally ignorant of its sources' identities. It deployed secure sockets layer encryption, like any banking or e-commerce site, to scramble its communication with all visitors and obscure its content from snoops. One of WikiLeaks' initial advisors, Ben Lurie, had invented an open-source version of that protocol for the web server software Apache OpenSSL that nearly half the world's websites use today. Encryption wasn't enough, however. WikiLeaks didn't want to simply hide what sources said, but rather completely obliterate any way of finding out who they were. The server that ran the site would keep no logs of any IP addresses of visitors. Assange would risk no Pennet-type subpoena debacle. But WikiLeaks added another unique trick to that end, a script that launched in the browser of any visitor to the site and generated commands that looked like randomly sized submissions to WikiLeaks' secure server. To anyone snooping on WikiLeaks' visitors, it would be impossible to distinguish between those who had come to the site to read its publications or make a donation and those who intended to drop secrets. Thanks to the cover traffic of spoofed submissions, everyone looked like a leaker. But it was Tor, of course, that would become WikiLeaks' core tool for protecting the anonymity of both its most sensitive sources and the site itself. The leaking site's submission system would run a Tor hidden service so that users could access it through rendezvous points in its volunteer network of relay nodes. The submission server's location would be just as hidden as that of the user. In theory, no one who wanted to launch a digital or legal attack on the site would even know where to begin, and sources would have the assurance from Tor that their identity was as anonymous as any web communication could be. In the early WikiLeaks developer communications leaked by John Young, Assange also describes physical drop-offs, mailing addresses where sources could anonymously send materials ranging from CDs to thumb drives to paper documents. Some would be deniable submissions addresses, and that the material would be encrypted with WikiLeaks' public key, and the drop-off handler wouldn't have the private key to unscramble the material. The uploader would never have any knowledge or responsibility for the leaked content. But other volunteers would accept unencrypted documents by post and even scan in reams of paper submissions and convert them to text files. The postal system, for anyone careful with fingerprints, has the potential to be more anonymous than any means of digital communication. But aside from its snailish speed, physical mailings with no return addresses have an obvious bug compared with onion-routed digital leaks. They don't provide a way to write back. In the United States, even setting up a post office box as a return address requires two forms of identification, hardly the ideal feedback channel for an anonymous leaker. Tor, on the other hand, allows instant feedback. WikiLeaks initially ran a chat room that used the instant messaging protocol IRC. An anonymous source communicating by Tor-protected instant messages could be questioned 1 second and respond the next with a verifying fact, another crucial document, or simple technical fixes. For Assange, Tor may have also possessed another unique capability, one that served a far more morally ambiguous purpose, as much an inherent bug in the system as a feature. Anyone who controls a node on the edge of the network with a few simple tools can read every unencrypted file that comes out of it. While Tor triple encrypts all the files it routes as a key step in its anonymity mechanism, that encryption is stripped away in the routing process. Any data that isn't encrypted before it enters Tor's maze of pipes won't be encrypted when it comes out the other end either. The service, after all, is designed to hide who the user is, not the data he or she is accessing or uploading. Traditional implementations of encryption like SSL and PGP can solve that problem. But as with every security mechanism, users slip up. And much of the web isn't configured for SSL. The result, apparent to thousands of the hacker types who run Tor nodes, is that a clever relay operator can essentially suck out copies of any unencrypted data that exits the anonymity network through the node he or she controls. Tor's administrators explain as much in the tool's documentation. Tor anonymizes the origin of your traffic, and it makes sure to encrypt everything inside the Tor network. But it does not magically encrypt all traffic throughout the internet, the site warns. Yes, the guy running the exit node can read the bytes that come in and out there. And many believe that WikiLeaks did exactly that. In a June 2010 profile of Assange, The New Yorker reported that before WikiLeaks' launch, a member of the project who ran a Tor exit node had noticed Chinese hackers using the relay to hide their tracks. Millions of documents were passing through the computer as the cyber spies went about their daily business of penetrating target servers and exfiltrating vast amounts of data. WikiLeaks volunteers began to record that traffic, and the immense bolus of information that they collected became a repository of documents that Assange would later tout in what may have been a less than honest bit of marketing as proof of WikiLeaks' early success. We have received over 1.2 million documents so far from dissident communities and anonymous sources, WikiLeaks boasted on its site circa 2007. When that New Yorker account of WikiLeaks' origin story became a headline on Wired.com, Assange issued a vague and circuitous denial. The imputation is incorrect, he told the tech news site The Register. The facts concern a 2006 investigation into Chinese espionage one of our contacts was involved in. Somewhere between none and a handful of those documents were ever released on WikiLeaks. But in another 2006 email published by John Young on Cryptome after his falling out with WikiLeaks, Assange describes something that sounds very much like hoovering up sensitive data as it spills out of a Tor node. Hackers monitor Chinese and other intel as they burrow into their targets, he wrote to Young. When they pull, so do we. The result, Assange continued breathlessly in that message, was an inexhaustible supply of material, nearly 100,000 documents, emails a day. The data flood, he wrote, included hacked internal documents from the Council on Foreign Relations, half a dozen foreign ministries, the United Nations, trade groups, the World Bank, even the Russian cybercriminal mafia. Mendax's hacker dream made reality. We're drowning. We don't even know a tenth of what we have or who it belongs to. We stopped storing it at 1 terabyte, he wrote. That data trove would have been 30 times the size of every text article stored on Wikipedia today. Whether or not those files were ever released, they marked the first seeds of WikiLeaks' power. Assange sounds in his email like a man made practically giddy over the wealth of secrets at his fingertips. We're going to crack the world open, he told Young. Let it flower into something new. When Applebaum told the guards on the Turkish-Iraqi border that he was a tourist, as he recounts the story, they laughed at him and waved him through, refusing to even stamp his passport. A taxi had taken him from Diyarbakir through the Turkish city of Batman and crossed into Iraq over a bridge straddling a river Applebaum describes as so brown and polluted that you wondered whether, if you fell in it, your bones would reach the bottom. In the Iraqi city of Zakho, he was picked up by his old Greenpeace friend and his wife in a white SUV with a Glock, an AK-47, and Browning 9mm handgun in the back seat. They drove to the northern town of Arbil, stopping to look in ghostly abandoned buildings along the highway. In one, they found children's drawings of helicopters firing on humans, rockets hitting buildings. In Arbil, Applebaum spent the next days photoblogging and interviewing locals, uploading the results with a satellite modem and the peer-to-peer file-sharing protocol BitTorrent. To any Iraqis who seemed computer-savvy, he distributed copies of the open-source operating system Linux, spreading free software like a hacker Johnny Appleseed. Applebaum found in his conversations that the local Kurds, unsurprisingly, were mostly happy with the U.S. invasion and the toppling of Saddam Hussein's regime. But from the Arabs who lived in Arbil, he claims to have heard more disturbing stories of soldiers who fired 50-caliber bullets at oncoming cars at checkpoints, killing their drivers and all passengers, rather than aim for the engine block. A man told Applebaum he kissed his wife every morning before leaving the house, thinking he would never see her again. Iraqis asked him sincerely whether Americans understood that they were normal people with homes and families. As an American, I found myself feeling pretty awful about what we'd contributed to, he says. In Kirkuk, the trio's vehicle broke down. While they waited for help on the side of the road, an enormous boom sounded over the hill behind them, and a black cloud of smoke rose from what seemed to be an oil refinery. Minutes later, two truckloads of soldiers, one American followed by one Iraqi, drove by. Applebaum's group laid low until his friend's co-workers could bring them a new car, and then drove on. But the incident reminded him of how close he was to real harm. When his friends left Iraq for Istanbul, he left with them. I was not in the greatest headspace, I guess, he says. But at some point, my desire to live started to outweigh my desire to be shot in a war zone. Applebaum returned to San Francisco and took a job at a security startup, building software that automatically scanned code for vulnerabilities. The company was acquired and his entire office was laid off. Soon after, he was at a party in the city's Mission District when news hit that the levees had broken in New Orleans. Hurricane Katrina had left nearly 2,000 dead and tens of thousands more stranded in sports stadiums used as shelters. When one of the partygoers tried to turn off the television and lighten the mood, Applebaum angrily grabbed the remote, turned up the volume, and refused to change the channel. Days later, he flew to Texas, created a press pass for an obscure news agency, and slipped into the Astrodome to interview Katrina's victims. I got through the checkpoints the same way you hack firewalls, by identifying and exploiting weaknesses, he says. Inside the makeshift shelter, He reported the inhabitants' stories of prison-like conditions. A man beaten in the shower, nightly curfews, women raped. Some of the evacuees believed that the Army Corps of Engineers had blown up New Orleans' levees to preserve more expensive real estate while flooding their parishes. Some other reports disputed those stories. But for Applebaum, this American disaster was a lot like the other American disaster I witnessed in Iraq, he says. The same thing, over and over again. The disconnection. The lack of humanity. Applebaum worked with a group of activists that collected radios and distributed them to the Astrodome's inhabitants to provide news for those trapped inside. Then he loaded up on provisions and drove to the Algiers neighborhood of New Orleans, moved into a house organized by the activist collective Common Ground, and helped to set up EVDO wireless internet connections so that the area's hard-hit inhabitants could register online with FEMA to receive aid. When Applebaum returned from New Orleans, his tour through two levels of hell had left him more committed than ever to the liberating powers of technology. But he had yet to find the community that would be his own cypherpunks, the crypto-obsessed peers who would enwrap him in a larger movement and push him to greater feats of crypto-anarchy. That group would be the Chaos Computer Club. In many ways, the CCC had progressed years ahead of Tim May and Eric Hughes' crypto liberation movement in California. Founded by the German hacker luminary Wau Holland in 1981, the Hamburg and Berlin-based nonprofit had been demonstrating the insecurity of public computer systems as early as 1984, when its hackers used the home terminal system created by the German postal system to transfer the equivalent of $50,000 from a bank to the CCC's accounts. The money was given back in a public ceremony the next day. With a true surveillance state looming just over the Berlin Wall, privacy, anti-authoritarianism, and the need for strong crypto had been steeped into the group's core. Almost exactly a year after his father's death, Applebaum flew to Berlin to attend the CCC's annual Chaos Communication Congress. The topic of his talk was the same problem that had troubled Julian Assange years earlier, one central to any activist who believes in the power of cryptography. How to keep encrypted data encrypted, even when authorities are standing over the user, rubber hose in hand, demanding the key. In his talk in Berlin, Applebaum walked the audience through a series of crypto schemes, grading various software and taking special pleasure in giving Apple an F. The user's unencrypted key could be extracted from a file Apple carelessly left on the computer's hard drive. And then he came to Julian Assange's very own solution to the problem of violent key extraction. Assange's 1997 invention, the crypto scheme rubber hose. In today's world, Applebaum told the audience of European hackers, this is probably going to get you killed. Applebaum cited the obvious issue. If the jailer knows his prisoner, Alice, is using rubber hose, he'll never stop torturing her to try and get more of the data that may be hidden on her hard drive. I don't think it's a good idea to never be able to prove you don't have any more secrets, Applebaum told the CCC crowd. Instead, he offered an idea for a new theoretical solution, MAID, or Mutually Assured Information Destruction. In the system Applebaum suggested, Alice keeps her cryptographic keys on a faraway server, accesses it only with Tor to keep its location obscured, and sets a certain time limit. If that time limit passes without Alice checking in, MAID automatically deletes all her keys. When Alice gives in to her jailer after either suffering through a certain period of torture or legal silence, she can show him that the keys no longer exist. Everything on the server full of secrets becomes permanently, irrevocably encrypted. You're not obstructing justice anymore, Applebaum explained. Justice was just too slow to catch you. In the questions period following the talk, Ralph Philip Weinman, the researcher who had developed rubber hose with Assange a decade earlier, stood up and laid into Applebaum, defending rubber hose and pointing out flaws in the MAID concept. They debated genially and then agreed to talk afterward. That conversation drew Applebaum into Assange's circle, albeit indirectly. Applebaum became a CCC regular, and Assange would attend the next year to introduce a project he was working on, WikiLeaks. Friends say they met at that wintry Berlin conference. Their paths must have felt uncannily parallel. Broken, wayward childhoods, IQs beyond those of the hated authorities that try to exert power over their lives, and a belief in the redemptive power of cryptography to defeat those forces. By Applebaum's fourth year at the conference, they had become close. Applebaum told me he woke up on New Year's Day after the 26th Chaos Communication Congress, in bed with Assange and two women. "That was how we rolled in 2010, he says, smiling. He later clarifies that they had busied themselves the night before with programming, not sex, and slept in different beds. I can dream, he adds. The two never spoke about Applebaum's critique of rubber hose. But the CCC conference where Applebaum spoke on the superiority of cryptography to violence, the young cypherpunk says, was the start of a good friendship. Browsing WikiLeaks archives from 2006 to late 2009, the years before it was catapulted onto the world stage, feels like opening a creaking door onto a dusty museum of badly organized, fascinating secret artifacts. A purported draft of a resignation letter from Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. A military report on the prevalence of hash smoking among a group of American soldiers. An internal video from a networking tech giant, Cisco, showing every television and movie screen in which it had purchased product placement. A list of sites to be censored by a Norwegian internet service provider. A report on incompetence among safety staff at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory. A censored image of the Belgian chief of police photoshopped into a pornographic scene. The handbooks of secret rituals for 9 different fraternities. It all started with a single unverified document. Whether by sniffing the Tor network, receiving it from a Tor mask source, or through other untraced means, Assange and WikiLeaks obtained and published its first leak. It was a Somalian government document calling for the assassinations of leaders in 2 rogue Somali states. John Young, who at that point hadn't broken off from the group, warned that the leak could easily be disinformation or a forgery. This is not to suggest leaks are not to be trusted, just not blindly so, for they are now standard tools for lying, smearing, and stinging by governments, corporations, persons of all demonics, Young wrote on the WikiLeaks mail list. In the end, WikiLeaks did post the Somalian leak, but with a breathless disclaimer. Is it a bold manifesto by a flamboyant Islamic militant with links to bin Laden? Or is it a clever smear by U.S. intelligence? As WikiLeaks' profile rose, the answer never surfaced and hardly mattered. Assange traveled to Kenya, moved into the compound of Doctors Without Borders, and continued to tout WikiLeaks at the World Social Forum, a collection of nonprofits and activists that shadowed the World Economic Forum. Seeking to create a WikiLeaks advisory board for Africa, he met with Mwalimu Mati, an organizer of Transparency International in Nairobi. We had tried many online whistleblowing sites, says Mati. But WikiLeaks' idea of using cryptography to separate the whistleblower and the source, that seemed to me to be very useful and clever. The Kenyan leak that would put WikiLeaks on the map, it turned out, had little to do with encryption. In 2004, the Nairobi government of Mwai Kibaki had taken power after the long reign of Daniel Arap Moi, promising an end to the corruption of the Moi regime. Kibaki commissioned a report into the previous regime's embezzlement, suspected to be billions of dollars, that would come to be known as the Kroll Report. But when Kibaki's government started to come under fire for its connections to the Moi indiscretions, the report wasn't released. Instead, someone printed it out and mailed it to Mati. It confirmed the worst. More than $2 billion siphoned to Moi's associates' properties in 28 countries, hundreds of millions given to his children, and even reports of currency counterfeiting by the regime's organized crime connections. Knowing that Nairobi's media was hardly independent enough to publish the bombshell report, Mati gave it to WikiLeaks. The Guardian picked up WikiLeaks' release and printed the front-page headline, "The Looting of Kenya." Mati and Assange followed up with another major leak, again sourced to an envelope that appeared on Mati's desk. It detailed the extrajudicial executions of members of a criminal gang called the Mungiki, a crackdown that led to the indiscriminate police killings of thousands of young men. After those exposés, the site's popularity rocketed, says Mati. Leaks began to flow in earnest to the site's submission system. A detailed account of the Cayman Islands tax shelters administered by the Swiss bank Julius Baer, an internal report from the mining giant Trafigura detailing the effects of its toxic dumping in the Ivory Coast that had been legally prevented from appearing in British media, Icelandic banking documents that would catalog the country's financial meltdown and eventually inspire a transformative legal movement in the volcanic island, and a collection of pager messages from September 11, 2001 that would catch the attention of one young analyst in a dusty base in Iraq. But for Assange, the most gratifying moment of WikiLeaks' ascendancy may have had a smaller but more personally meaningful target: the Church of Scientology. Since the days of Pennet and Suburbia, the church's lawyers had continued to intimidate anyone that leaked its manifold secrets, both to traditional media and digital outlets. So when WikiLeaks published a 208-page strategy manual that seemed to have been written by founder L. Ron Hubbard himself and detailed strong-arm tactics for attacking journalists and even tricking airlines into revealing their flight details, the church responded with its usual suppressive methods. A letter from the group's lawyer asked WikiLeaks to remove the documents immediately. Assange, needless to say, did not. And instead of merely holding an 11-person protest as he had in his cypherpunk days, this time he fired back with both barrels. WikiLeaks will not comply with legally abusive requests from Scientology any more than WikiLeaks has complied with similar demands from Swiss banks, Russian offshore stem cell centers, former African kleptocrats, or the Pentagon. WikiLeaks will remain a place where people of the world may safely expose injustice and corruption, read a letter sent back to the church's lawyer. In response to the attempted suppression, WikiLeaks will release several thousand additional pages of Scientology material next week. Today, the site has a special Scientology section in its archives. It holds more than 100 documents, one of the largest collections of the church's internal papers stored anywhere in the world. In July 2010, 3 months after WikiLeaks had released a clip of a U.S. Apache helicopter gunning down civilians and journalists in a Baghdad suburb, and just days before the group would publish 76,000 secret military documents from Afghanistan, Julian Assange was scheduled to deliver the keynote address to an audience of thousands at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference, a gathering held at the venerable Hotel Pennsylvania in New York. But when the keynote began, it was a young, dark-haired American, not Assange, who walked onto the stage. He wore a T-shirt that read, "Stop Snitching," a reference to Adrian Lamo, and was introduced by the conference organizers merely as WikiLeaks. "Hello to all my friends and fans in domestic and international surveillance. I'm here today because I believe we can make a better world," Applebaum told a bewildered crowd that had expected a blonder, more Australian figure. "Julian, unfortunately, can't make it, because we don't live in that better world right now, because we haven't yet made it. I wanted to make a little declaration for the federal agents that are standing in the back of the room and the ones that are standing in the front of the room, and to be very clear about this. I have on me in my pocket some money, the Bill of Rights, and a driver's license, and that's it. I have no computer system, I have no telephone, I have no keys, no access to anything. There's absolutely no reason that you should arrest me or bother me. And just in case you were wondering, I'm an American, born and raised, who's unhappy. I'm unhappy with how things are going. He explained that he worked for Tor, but that he wasn't at the conference to represent his employer. I'm certain they wouldn't be too unhappy with me speaking here, but they certainly didn't know about it before this moment. Then he explained that he believed in standing up for human rights and social change, for free speech without retribution. To quote from Tron, he said, I fight for the user. For the next hour and 15 minutes, Applebaum railed against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan in steady, simple rhetoric. He lashed out at WikiLeaks critics and Lamo, whose name he refused to even utter, for informing on Bradley Manning. He argued against the idea of speaking truth to power. You stick it to the man and show the man how it is? Well, I think that's stupid. Power knows power because power's in power, he told the crowd. It's important to take this power and give it to people who are not simply the ones who make the decisions. Give it to the people who vote them in and out of office. The people in power cannot issue a denial when everyone knows the truth, he continued. They can't redact a document when everyone has a copy of it in their heart and in their mind. And then he delivered the news. Applebaum announced that WikiLeaks submissions system, which had been down the previous months, had been redesigned and relaunched. He displayed the Tor Hidden Services page that any leaker could visit to anonymously feed documents to the site. And then Applebaum went further, directly appealing for the audience of hackers, many of whom held day jobs in corporate cybersecurity, to become an army of leakers. I never expect to work in the corporate security industry again. But that's okay. I think this is far more important than anything like that, Applebaum said, with a vulnerable note in his voice. Some of you won't make this choice, and that's okay. And some of you will pretend not to make this choice, and you'll go in deep. And thank you for that. Applebaum paused. The audience response began with a few sparse claps, as if the crowd wasn't yet sure about its commitment to the role they were being asked to take on. Then it slowly grew, rippling through the room, and swelled into a steady roar of applause. As his talk ended, Applebaum exited the stage and seemed to reappear, donning a black hoodie. In fact, the hoodie wearer was a decoy. Applebaum had slipped out a back exit to board a flight to Berlin. While he surreptitiously left the hotel, the collateral murder video was projected onto an enormous screen. Apache gunfire echoed over a silent throng of hackers. A dark orientation video for the newborn leaking movement.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.